Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Monday, December 9th, 2024. Small business owners say taxes demanded by the Juba City Council are way too high.
Okay, she wants money. Security, she wants money. So even revenue, she wants money. But I told her that money later, reduce it. They refuse.
And could a mysterious disease that's killed dozens of people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo spread around the globe?
I think that this is very early days and we don't have a complete picture of what's occurring, and there may be a lot that's lost in translation. So until we have diagnostic tests available to determine what's causing these illnesses, I think it's premature.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Small business owners in Juba say they are on the brink of collapse because of what they say are exorbitant taxes imposed on them by the Juba City Council. Some women operating salon businesses in the Manuki market say the city council is merciless. For VOA News, Dennis Ligonye reports from Juba.
In the South Sudanese capital, scores of women and others trying to eke out a living have started up small businesses. A saloon owner operating under blue-painted iron sheets in the Libya market called the Monoki says high taxes charged by the Juba City Council is forcing her to close. The woman, who does not want her name mentioned for fear of government reprisal, says she cannot afford to stay in business.
That money is too much. I don't have a weave, just printing. I told her if any wasaka. She came, she wants money. Security, she wants money. So even revenue, she wants money. But I told her that money later, reduce it. They refuse.
Another saloon owner on the same lane, known as Aunt Grace, says some city council workers are arrogant and refuse to work out a compromise.
I'm a single mother, first of all. I have orphans that I'm paying at school also. So this money is too much. Because at least the last year we paid like 300 something. It was not as much like this. When we try to complain, some of them, they tell you that it is not you who paid for us our education.
Mariam Ann, another saloon business owner who is in her 50s, says she wants the city council to have mercy on them so that they can be able to feed their families.
Since last year, we have been struggling to pay them, but these 2 years, there is no money. Even they know there is no money in South Sudan, but they say that we should pay $1 million. Where are we going to get that money? Let them also see that we are renting in iron sheets. Let them reduce for us such that we can manage. Tomorrow, they are going to put in a padlock. Now, how are we going to feed our children? There's sickness, there's school fees. You have to pay rent from the same money. It's a burden for us.
Timon Marcelino, director of Monuki Block of the City Council, says the rate scheduled for traders was passed by Juba City Council in compliance with the Juba Chamber of Commerce, and there is nothing he can do to change it.
That is the prerogative of Juba City Council, and I'm just a part of Juba City Council. What we are requesting is according to our budget line, according to the rate schedule of Juba City Council. This is what we are demanding from our traders, not specific traders. It is general traders. And if there is a complaint, the complaint has to come to us through the right channels of Chamber of Commerce.
Businessman Nimeri Alfred, who has a disability, says he can no longer take care of his family since the city council destroyed his phone charging kiosk in a custom market. He now struggles through shoe signing to buy fuel for his tricycle.
From that time, even I could not bathe, I could not eat. Now I lose hope. It becomes so difficult for me. For 1 week, I did not even know where to walk. Because the morning I came, what is there, it has been already collected by the people that night. Then even the only iron seat, suppose if they can leave for me to remove it alone so that I go and benefit in it also, but they spoil it completely. From that day up to today, I'm still suffering. I'm not suffering completely.
A document document issued by the Monuki Block indicates the saloon business owners have been ordered to pay an equivalent of 1.4 million South Sudanese pounds or $350 for an application, trading licenses, ground rent markets, rent of value of their shop, beautification of markets, and a sanitary license. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Ghana's ruling New Patriotic Party candidate, Vice President Mahmoud Bawumia, has conceded in the presidential election ahead of the Electoral Commission's announcement that the results and pledge to support the transition. VOA's Paul Ndiho is in Accra and has this report.
Thank you, Yahayis. It was something that most people did not expect. The results of the elections came in so fast, and the Vice President, Mahmoud Bawumia, conceded defeat was something that took a lot of Ghanaians by surprise. As we talk right now, the mood on the streets is that of people are still excited. They're talking about the elections. They're talking about the election process, how everything was smooth, fair, and credible. When you run into people who are involved in the process, they tell you they've never seen anything like this from a foreigner's perspective or from a journalist's perspective. I thought this was one of the most peaceful elections that I've covered, one of the most credible elections that have been witnessed. And so I have to give credit to the Ghanaian people, the authorities who organized the election, to the fact that they were able to pull this thing off without a hitch.
And how about the parliamentary elections?
So it looks like the opposition, NDC, is going to sweep parliament. They haven't concluded counting the results yet. But I can comfortably say that the opposition is going to have a comfortable lead going into this next session. Why? Because they overwhelmingly swept the entire country. Across all regions, they did very, very well. The ruling party, for some reason, their messaging did not resonate with people, so they ended up losing a lot of parliamentary seats. But I can guarantee you that this mandate is going to be a great one for President-elect John Mahama once he assumes office, because he has everything that he needs to take the country forward. And if he really wants to push the agenda that people elected him on, he's got a comfortable parliament to help him do that.
And I'm sure you're aware of it, Paul. Ghana's economic woes dominated the election after the gold and cocoa producers went through a crisis of default and currency devaluation, ending with a $3 billion International Monetary Fund bailout.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was all about the economy, the economy, the economy. Why? Because every single person that I've talked to since I've been here, they complain about the high cost of living. They complain about how the money they are making in relation to how things are is not adding up. So from young students to people who sell things on the street to professionals who do this on a daily basis, they all talked about how the economy really hurt the ruling party. Things have not been the same. People are struggling to put food on the table for their children. The salaries that people make were not just enough to get them by. So to that extent, that's why you see people voted overwhelmingly for opposition, hoping that they can reset the economy and do things better.
And lastly, Paul, the organization, the way things went so smoothly, your overall assessment of Ghanaian politics relating to the election?
I think when it comes to the maturity, I think Ghana has demonstrated once again that they are a beacon of hope for democracy in West Africa and a beacon of hope for democracy in Africa. Why? Because they have consistently, since 1992, transferred power peacefully.
That is VOA's Paul Ndiho. He was speaking from Accra, Ghana, with my colleague, VOA Africa News Tonight host, Yahyaeus Wuhibe. Africa's Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the Africa CDC, says it's working around the clock to identify a new disease in the Democratic Republic of Congo that has claimed at least 79 lives and infected hundreds more. The first patient fell ill with the disease on October 24th. Should we be worried that the disease will spread to the rest of the continent, perhaps even the rest of the world? I put that question to Dr. Amash Adalja, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Public Security and a physician who focuses on emerging infectious disease.
I think at this point, there's no real cause for the world to worry. I think that this is very early days and we don't have a complete picture of what's occurring. And there may be a lot that's lost in translation. So until we have diagnostic tests available to determine what's causing these illnesses, I think it's premature to panic about this, but I think it is important to be proactive as the WHO is being, as Africa CDC is being, to try and run this down. I think it's important to also remember that these cases started in October and there was a 6-week or so delay before they were notified to public health authorities. So what happened may have already came and went. It's unclear whether this is ongoing. The other thing to keep in mind is the fact that there's a 6-week delay, that it's been difficult to get there, that it's several hundred miles away from major laboratory centers, tells you that this is occurring in a remote area, which may delimit its ability to spread. If this is so hard to get to, it's very hard to get out of. So that may be kind of a silver lining in that whatever is occurring there is quite isolated from the rest of the world.
But by the same token, you know, being that it seems to be a remote area, the DRC, does it make it harder to figure out what's causing the disease and how it's spreading?
Because it's occurring in a remote area of the DRC where there are not healthcare resources to be able to do diagnostic tests, where there may not be a lot of medical expertise, yes, that has made it harder. But I think within the next 24 hours or so, we should be getting some lab sample results back from a laboratory that receives specimens from the area.
What are the symptoms? Describe the symptoms, if you would.
From what we have heard, the symptoms include fever, chills, muscle aches and pains, shortness of breath, respiratory symptoms, and also we're hearing anemia as well is something that they're finding in some of the patients. So that doesn't really map on to anything quite perfectly. So it could be a variety of different infections. It could be more than one infection, because remember, the diagnostic testing there is very constrained, so they may not actually be able to identify who is a case patient and who is not. This could end up being something normal like malaria, typhoid fever. It could be Ebola or Marburg. So I think that the possibilities are very wide right now because we don't have good information, and the information we've gotten is delayed. There's been a lag time from when this outbreak occurred. And as I said, we don't even know how much it's ongoing anymore because a lot of this was happening in October and November.
Some of those things you mentioned are spread by airborne. You know, are they worried? Are infectious disease experts like yourself worried that it could be airborne?
Well, I think based on the fact that there's respiratory symptoms, we are concerned that there's respiratory spread, which is more efficient. But again, we have not seen this move out of that area. There really hasn't been any reports from other parts of the DRC with symptoms consistent with this. And the fact is, even if something is spread through the respiratory route, it may be easier to spread. But if it's happening in a remote area, it may not be able to actually get out of that area because it's still constrained based on the limited human-to-human contact that goes on between this area where these cases are occurring and the rest of the country, the rest of the province. So that also will still play a role in delimiting it, even if it is spread through a more efficient route.
What precautions, if any, are being taken in the DRC right now to try to stop the spread of it?
I think that they are isolating individuals that might have symptoms consistent with it in that area of the DRC. But it's really premature to say what are the appropriate responses because we actually don't know if this is something ordinary or something unusual yet, because information is very limited and it's going to really hinge upon the diagnostic testing to understand what's made these people sick.
That is Dr. Amash Adalja, a physician and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Public Security. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Dr. Adalja was speaking with me from the U.S. eastern city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, after Syria's deposed president flees to Russia, Syrians express their hopes for the future. Find out more when we come back. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. In the wake of Syria's government collapse, some civilians say they hope the rebels' victory will bring freedom and prosperity. Analysts warn, though, that the future is far from certain at this time of geopolitical upheaval. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Moawiya Atrash and Ahmad Falaha in Hama, Syria.
Amid destruction and death left by the lightning rebel advance and Syria's government collapse, civilians say they are cautiously optimistic that what may be a massive shift in regional geopolitics may also be, for them, a change for the better. This is Ghalib Al-Hajusa, a resident of Salamiya in the Hama region of Syria.
Autocracy is not acceptable from any side, from an individual or a group in Syria. This is the Syrian people's will, liberty, and free and clean elections. Syria is a democratic and civilized country. This is what is supposed to be.
In less than 2 weeks, rebel forces have taken over major cities and towns, and now the capital, Damascus. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has reportedly fled the country. This comes after nearly 14 years of war in Syria, the last few of which are often called frozen. 500,000 people have been killed and 13 million have fled their homes. Many families hope to soon return. Umm Mahmoud is a displaced Syrian woman in the city of Hama.
We were displaced, but we will return to home soon. I am very happy today, more than you can imagine.
The Syrian Civil Defense Force, an opposition aid and rescue group, also called the White Helmets, called the victory the end of this dark period and the start of a new era for Syria. Rebel forces, led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, have said they will practice religious tolerance and respect Syria's multicultural population. But some analysts say the group's Islamist identity and past affiliations with other groups, such as al-Qaeda and al-Nusra, creates doubts about their stated intentions. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Muawiya Atrash in the Hama region of Syria, VOA News.
India is not supporting the creation of a shared currency among the nine-nation BRICS grouping, but it is trying to promote trade in its local currency, according to analysts in New Delhi. Incoming U.S. President Donald Trump recently warned BRICS nations against efforts to replace the dollar with an alternative currency. Anjana Pasricha has more from New Delhi.
India is not pursuing the creation of a common BRICS currency, a potential initiative that has met with strong pushback from U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. He has threatened 100% tariffs on products from the nine-member BRICS bloc if it replaces the U.S. dollar with another currency or backs an alternative to the greenback. Analysts say mistrust and differences between major BRICS members, such as India and China, are a huge stumbling block in moving ahead with a shared currency. Chintamani Mahapatra is with the Kalinga Institute of Indo-Pacific Studies.
India is not supportive of this particular initiative. Any common currency is not going to help anyone. Only the dominant countries like China ultimately will dictate. So it is very difficult to develop a consensus to have a common currency.
The core BRICS group, China, Russia, India, Brazil, and South Africa, expanded this year to include Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Ethiopia, and Egypt. Talk of a BRICS currency gained some momentum in 2022 after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia following the Ukraine war and growing tensions between the West and China. But the alliance of emerging countries is too diverse to make a shared currency viable, according to Mahapatra.
We don't have a common market. We don't have any common trade policy. We have nothing in common.
However, India and some other BRICS countries have stepped up efforts to trade in their local currencies to reduce dependence on the U.S. dollar, said trade analyst Biswajit Dhar.
There are 17 countries that have been identified by the government of India with whom India wants to trade in either rupees or a bilateral currency.
Those countries include Russia. New Delhi, which did not join US sanctions, is paying for its massive oil imports from Moscow in rupees. That also presents challenges, according to Dhar.
India runs a huge trade deficit vis-a-vis Russia, which means that when India is buying a lot of oil from Russia and it is paying in rupees, Russia doesn't know what to do with the whole stock of rupees that it is holding now.
Indian External Affairs Minister Subramanian Jaishankar has said that moving away from the greenback is not part of India's economic policy. That, say analysts, is because India's strategic interests are generally aligned with the US. Anjana Pusricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
U.S. President Joe Biden's recent trip to Africa, his first and only trip to the continent before leaving office next month, was aimed at strengthening U.S.-Africa ties and shining a spotlight on the U.S.-backed Lobito Corridor, a massive infrastructure project focused on a rail that ships ore from the DR Congo and other African countries to the port of Lobito. 70% of the world's cobalt right now used to make electric vehicle batteries comes from the DRC. Christian Gerard Nima, a China Africa analyst and non-resident scholar in the Carnegie Africa program, tells me that the U.S. is far behind China when it comes to gaining access to Africa's precious metals, especially cobalt.
The Lobito Corridor project is not a U.S. project. It's a commercial project by Trafigura and its consortium. The U.S. is intervening in the project because the U.S. is providing a financial support through the DFC. And that project is basically railway and maybe expanding a bit of the railway in the port of Zambia and refurbish the ports of the railway in the DRC. The second part that you mentioned about copper, the critical minerals being shipped to the U.S., it's not also the first time, even though it can be used. It was through Durban, but it's not really the first time that happened. So here, yes, we do have a case where now minerals, copper, essentially not cobalt, copper being shipped to the U.S. by most of it by Chinese miners in the DRC selling copper to U.S. buyers in the U.S. because the demand in the U.S. is higher than the China, and China being fooled now, the demand, the price that the Chinese buyers are offering to miners in DRC are low compared to what the U.S. the Americans are offering. So you have a lot of copper that's only being processed and to metal, to 100% metal, out of the DRC, sold by Chinese smelters and Chinese companies, are sold to the U.S.
With his recent efforts, has President Biden been able to even the playing field at all with China in terms of, you know, access to these precious metals?
No. He's not been able to level the playing field because for him to level the playing field, they need to have mining companies on the ground, which they don't have. To level the playing field, they really need to have actors on the ground. And the Lobito Corridor is just a logistic project so far. And it's really important for people to know that there's not really much of a leveling of a playing field, despite, and this is, I might sound very critical to the U.S., but beyond the narrative that's presented, there's no real American companies on the ground. We do have cobalt in Zambia, who's trying to start a new operation in Zambia, but we do not have an American project in the DRC. And so far, that American, and since there's no American project, there's no really leveling the playing field as we would have expected if there was really real competition happening.
That is Christian Gerard Nima. He's a China Africa analyst and non-resident scholar in the Carnegie Africa program. He was speaking with me earlier today from Mauritius, an island country in the Indian Ocean, east of Africa.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
And that wraps it up for us this Monday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed the beginning of this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with a group performing the Avokaya song. We've been listening to an African group performing an Avokaya song. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Peter Hunvey, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden recently became the first American president to visit Angola. Throughout my presidency, he said, it's been the goal of the United States to build a strong partnership with peoples and nations across the continent of Africa. African leadership will be important going forward, as one out of every four human beings on Earth will live in Africa by the year 2050. It will be up to this next generation to expand access to clean energy, tackle threats of global health, and grow a global middle class. 2 years ago, the United States pledged to deliver $55 billion in new investments in Africa and to mobilize American businesses to close new deals with African partners. This plan has already proven very productive, said President Biden.
More than 20 heads of U.S. government agencies and members of my cabinet have traveled to Africa, delivering over $40 billion in investments thus far. And we've announced nearly 1,200 new business deals between African-American companies and American companies, totaling worth $52 billion, including investments in solar energy, telecom, mobile finance, infrastructure, and partnerships with American Airlines.
Being all in on Africa means making sure African voices are heard at the tables that matter most, declared President Biden.
Under my leadership in the United States, we brought in the African Union as a permanent member of the G20 economies, and we insisted on more African representation among the leaders of the International Monetary Fund and other world financial institutions. We've also pushed to ensure that developing nations do not have to choose between paying down unsustainable debt and being able to invest in their own people.
The United States continues to be the world's largest provider of humanitarian aid and development assistance, and that's going to increase, promised President Biden.
I'm announcing over $1 billion in new humanitarian support for Africans displaced from homes by historic droughts and food insecurity. We know African leaders and citizens are seeking more than just aid. You seek investment. So the United States is expanding our relationship all across Africa, from assistance to aid, to investment to trade, moving from patrons to partners to help bridge the infrastructure gap.
Today, the United States and Angola, said President Biden, are standing shoulder to shoulder, working together for the mutual benefit of their people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.